And now, broadcasting live on Star Worldwide Networks, it's time for Your Road to Personal Addiction Recovery with Dr. William Nelson. If you suffer from addiction to opiate pain relievers, heroin, alcohol, or other substances, we're here to give you hope and help you overcome your addiction. Now, here's your host, Dr. Nelson.
About 100 years ago, a gentleman named Bill Wilson, or in his organization was just known as Bill, had a spiritual awakening where through a process of spiritual metanoia, he was able to overcome his lifelong struggle with alcohol. And for those of you familiar, Bill is Bill Wilson, and he was the author of the big book used in Alcoholics Anonymous. And since that time, anyone who has struggled with alcohol, and everybody whose life is affected by it, the challenges and the things that alcohol does to our families and our society and for each of us as individuals, is well aware that Alcoholics Anonymous is a program with requires abstinence and a process called the 12 steps. And up until recently, anyone who was serious, quote unquote serious, about dealing with their problem with alcohol would automatically be assumed to adopt and pursue that form of treatment. And this includes in any sort of therapeutic relationship with doctors, with therapists. And basically is like, if you're not doing 12-step and abstinence via Alcoholics Anonymous approach, you're not serious. So, and the challenge with that is that approach, although it's been life-changing, life-saving for many people, isn't statistically successful. And it's not because the program doesn't work. It's because alcohol is a challenging condition. It's a challenging disease. It's multifactorial. There's so many things that need to occur. And that approach, although has been successful, the statistics don't show that it is as wonderful and as successful as one might be led to believe. And, you know, on average, people say that about only 10% of the people that could benefit from alcohol treatment pursue treatment with Alcoholics Anonymous. And then out of those, about 10% are successful over the course of a year to 2 years with sobriety. And not to say that it's bad, but it's not for everybody. And so today we're going to talk about a different approach. Those of you who have been on this podcast or listened before, you may be aware of a program called Sinclair Method. It was developed by a researcher named John David Sinclair, who was doing research in alcohol and addictions, and was led to go to Northern Europe and was funded to study the benefits of using naltrexone, which is an opiate blocker, and taken prior to the consumption of alcohol. And so now we have what's known as the Sinclair Method, which is kind of in opposition to Alcoholics Anonymous for two reasons. One, it's the use of medication in the approach to alcohol use disorder, and which Alcoholics Anonymous does not support. And the other, it includes the consumption of alcohol during treatment. And so that leads us to today's podcast. Today's podcast was recorded in Asheville, North Carolina, a week or two ago on May 26th. And this was recorded at the Deerhaven Gardens Alcohol Treatment Center. And this treatment center is the first of its kind. It was founded by Pearl Baker Katz. She's the founder and CEO of Deerhaven Gardens, which is the first of its kind, first in the United States, groundbreaking. It's a luxury addiction treatment center located in this beautiful hillside, amazing house in Asheville, North Carolina, and catering to women only. And Pearl's not on the podcast, but I wanted to mention Pearl. She's a wonderful person. And she basically decided to do this when two of her close friends were helped with their problem with alcohol via the Sinclair Method. And Pearl contacted Claudia Christian, who is on the podcast, and Claudia is a successful TV and movie personality, author, and she's also, I came to know Claudia because she has had great success with her own dealing with alcohol use disorder through the use of Sinclair Method. And because when she first heard about it, she was couldn't find anybody to treat her, couldn't find anybody to prescribe the naltrexone medication. And because of her success using that method, she took it upon herself to form the C3 Foundation, which is a nonprofit that she formed. And the sole goal of the C3 is to educate both patients and doctors on the benefits of this unique approach to alcohol and alcohol use disorder. It's been very successful. And that's how I first heard about Sinclair Method from a patient. And they said, hey, would you please help me with this? And I said, I don't know what it is. And they referred me to the C3 Foundation, and Claudia has a number of books and a wonderful TED Talk on Sinclair Method and a movie as well, a documentary. So Claudia is one of the other participants in the Roundtable podcast. Also, we have Luann de Lesseps, and Luann is an American television personality, a model, an author, a singer, a cabaret singer. She's also a countess due to a previous marriage. And she's, those of you are familiar, you may know her from the Real Housewives of New York. And she was one of the regulars on that successful reality TV show. And word has it, I was sworn to secrecy, but I just saw it on Page 6 on the website, that she has recently agreed to star in a new reality TV show. And it's going to be modeled around two fabulous socialites, Luann being one, that are going to be thrown into a middle American, you know, kind of meat and potatoes town, where these socialites are going to be interacting with the town locals. So it sounds like it's going to be a fun show. And she was just excited when we were there. She spoke about just signing the contract. I don't think it even has a name for the show yet, but word has it, it's going to start filming in July. So look forward to that. And I also should shout out, she also, Luann also has put together a non-alcoholic wine called Fosé Rosé. So I've tasted it. It's delicious. And for those of you who like wine and don't want alcohol, that would be a wonderful thing for you to add to your process. And then I also have, lastly, Gabrielle Lumasenet. And I've known Gabrielle for a while. She is a life coach and specializes in treatment and counseling, and has significant experience with helping patients and her clients working through the challenges of alcohol use disorder that are in addition to the consumption of alcohol. So whether that be personal traumas, PTSD, trauma work, any other the comorbidities that one might have that are the underlying cause of alcohol use disorder. And I'll lastly introduce myself for those of you tuning in for the first time. You're listening to Your Road to Personal Addiction Recovery, and my name is Dr. William Nelson. I am a doctor specializing in alcohol use disorder, opiate use disorder, and I have a practice in Scottsdale, Arizona. So with that, we will, I'll let Robin turn over the podcast, and you'll listen to the whole thing in its entirety. So thanks for listening, and hope you get a lot out of this. It was really excited to be there. This is the grand opening of this new facility.
Alcohol and alcohol use disorder is a problem that is larger than most people understand. Most people might know someone, friend, family, that has a problem with alcohol, alcohol use disorder. But in our culture, because alcohol is so commonplace, that it's oftentimes perceived as not as big a problem as it actually is, and how it affects families, how it affects health, how it affects our society in general. We are here to celebrate the opening of the first clinic in the United States that's going to use a revolutionary treatment called Sinclair Method for the treatment of alcohol use disorder. We're in Asheville, North Carolina, a beautiful environment, at a place called Deer Haven.
Hey guys, we're just gonna start over because of that big bang.
Yeah. Oh, and that was such a good intro.
I know, you knocked it out of the park.
What did I say? I want to say it again. I don't know. Where should I look?
I feel like it should be more you're just talking.
Yeah.
Okay.
Cameras.
All right.
Yeah.
It's a reality show now.
Okay.
No, I'm going
to. We'll talk to each other.
This is the expert.
Yeah. Still rolling. Okay. All right. Here we go. And action.
We're here in Asheville, North Carolina. A group of us together, Luann, Claudia, and Gabrielle, we're here to celebrate the opening of the first clinic of its type in the United States. This clinic is an inpatient facility for the treatment of alcohol use disorder, where, believe it or not, the people who are here to be treated are gonna drink alcohol. And if you're sitting on your chair going, what in the world are these people talking about, and they've lost their mind, congratulations, you're not the first person to have that reaction. And so we're here just to explain what the Sinclair Method is, how it works, and how it's affecting people's lives, improving the results if someone is attempting to overcome their problem with alcohol. So welcome.
Thank you.
So I'm Dr. William Nelson, and I'm a doctor in Scottsdale, Arizona. I specialize in the treatment of alcohol and opiate disorder. And so I'll let everybody introduce themselves.
I'm Luann de Lesseps. From New York.
And why are you here?
Oh, sorry. Well, I'm here because I was invited to come to the opening with my good friend Pearl, who is the founder, who is has the beautiful heart of giving to other people and opening up her home so people can recover from alcohol addiction. So it's very special for me to be here and to experience the first ever place where you can come to get treated for alcohol with the Sinclair Method, which I want to learn more about because I don't know a lot about it.
Good. Beautiful.
My name is Claudia Christian. I'm the CEO founder of the C3 Foundation, which is the only nonprofit organization devoted to the advocacy of the Sinclair Method in the world. I've done a TEDx talk on the subject, and I've written two books, and I've made a documentary film called One Little Pill. I also used this treatment myself in 2009 for my own alcohol misuse successfully. So I was on it for 9 years and I've been sober for 3.5. Dr. Nelson has been an integral part of my nonprofit organization as well. And it's wonderful to be with you here and to meet Luann.
Thank you.
And of course, Gabrielle is also was recently on our Twitch channel. So it's just a love fest here.
And I'm Gabrielle Annett. I'm a duly licensed counselor in substance use and mental health, and have been on the project to get to this point, the project of Deer Haven, to get to opening for about a year. And I am thrilled and excited to be here, and am a huge advocate of the treatment that we're doing here and was a part of creating the curriculum and the treatment.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah.
So I want to just set the stage. It's probably 10 years ago or so, I had a patient that came to me and said, Doc, I got this new treatment, and it's called the Sinclair Method, and it uses a pill that you take 1 hour before drinking. And what this does, it allows you to extinguish the reward that one receives upon drinking. And so a person will naturally just be able to reduce the amount of their drinking without having to go into the delirium tremens, or we have severe withdrawals. And over time, if combined with proper counseling, therapy, and maybe helping you to create a sober life, has incredible success rate. And I'm like, yeah, right. So I was an optimistic skeptic, and I was led to Claudia's TED Talk. And here's this beautiful woman, very well-spoken, very articulate and knowledge-based, And I'm like, I can believe this based on her credibility. So I have you to thank for that, introducing me to this. And Claudia, I'll let you tell your story. And I think it's amazing what you've done. I think Claudia will tell, but originally she couldn't even get this medication in the United States, needed to get it in a foreign country.
Yeah, this was, I went to my general practitioner and told him about it. I brought in the clinical studies. I brought in the book that Dr. Roy Escapa wrote, which has the rather unfortunate title of The Cure for Alcoholism. So people are prone to skepticism when they hear something that is super easy, pop a pill, blah, blah, blah. Right. So I was met with an incredible amount of negativity. One doctor told me that he wasn't going to give me a, quote, opiate. And I said, excuse me, sir, this is an opiate blocker. This is an opiate antagonist. Look it up in your little black medicine book, for gosh sake. You know, I was getting more and more frustrated because I was, first of all, it's extremely shameful and difficult for a patient to come to a doctor and admit that they have a problem. Mm-hmm. The doctor that I went to was also I had many family members that went to that doctor. I know that there is a, you know, privacy act, but I still felt very vulnerable saying to him, look, I know I have a drinking problem. Mm-hmm. And when I told him how much I was drinking, he literally said, oh, that's not so bad. I have about a bottle a night myself. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking to myself, okay, this is really uncomfortable at this point. I tried another doctor, and that doctor refused me as well. At that point, because I had read the book and because I come from a family of doctors and researchers and cancer researchers, and I have a lot of medical professionals in my family, the book made sense to me. The method made sense to me. The fact that it was based on Pavlovian theory. Everything made sense to me. The opiate antagonist blocking the reward center of the brain and causing you to decrease or stop that action, in my case, drinking. I don't know if people out there know this, but it also works for gambling and other issues. So once I was refused multiple times, I got rather angry, and I ended up ordering my medication, which I am not recommending anyone to do because you don't know what you're getting, and it's illegal in many places. But I ordered it online from an Indian pharmacy. And at this point, I had been through a really bad, my only medical detox, because I thought I was going to have a stroke when I was cold turkey detoxing off of a binge. And at that point, I was desperate because I knew the cravings would start to kick in. I was 2 months in sobriety, and I knew that pretty soon those cravings are going to kick in, and the medication took forever to get to me.
Right.
I think it took a couple of months. So by that time, I was almost 4 months sober, and the cravings were starting to hit. And it was sort of like rolling the dice, I would say. I had tried everything, literally everything that there was available to try. And at this point, I thought, if this doesn't work for me, I will die. It was that simple. I knew that the next binge would kill me because I had already poisoned myself multiple times. So
naltrexone really saved you. And it's funny because we don't know what that is. I mean, I've never heard of naltrexone.
That's the thing. I was in a rehab facility. Other people have been in rehab facilities. They never mentioned any medication.
Right.
There are six or seven medications.
I've been to two, and I've never heard of naltrexone.
This is the amazing thing. It was approved in 1994 for alcohol use disorder.
Then I went into looking it up a bit and finding out more.
Yeah.
And it's just incredible that
they don't talk about
Topiramax. Yeah.
They don't give you gabapentin for withdrawal. They don't give you a camprasate. They don't teach you about anything. It's just my way or the highway, 12 steps, just don't drink, don't touch it.
Well, is it a pharmaceutical thing also that it's not expensive so that the pharmaceutical companies aren't making money? I mean, is it that?
It's a generic,
is it political?
It's a generic medication, and
right.
It doesn't have the oomph of a Viagra behind it.
Well, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah, the
that's
billions of dollars from a pharma company. So, but on the other hand, alcoholism is not sexy.
Right.
It's not sexy. People would rather give to puppies or invest largely in erectile dysfunction because that's sexy.
Right.
You know, alcoholism is not sexy. So is there a pharma 100%. Company that wants to come out and make a naltrexone, for instance, with a anti-nausea component to it?
No, because,
and then brand it as the Sinclair Method pill?
Right.
Hey, go for it. Steal my idea, folks. Take it.
It might be helpful. It might be helpful. You know, the original studies, the way in which you take the medication is you take the medication and then you wait an hour and then you drink. But when you write the prescription as that. As a doctor, the pharmacist will call me and say, you're writing the prescription the wrong way. You need to take the pill and be abstinent and not drink. So they changed the way in which it's being prescribed and being taken. I don't really understand why, but
they changed it
because the FDA was uncomfortable approving it with a combination of drinking, even though the clinical studies proved that people who drank on it did better.
Right.
So there are some doctors, like my doctor in Los Angeles, who insisted to the pharmacy to write on the label, taken 1 hour prior to drinking alcohol. Mm-hmm. That's very rare because, but he went out on a limb and said, "No, I'm going to educate the pharmacy."
Mm-hmm. It's funny. Originally, when I started to write those scripts, I would continually get calls from the pharmacists say, "Hey, you got this wrong." And like, "No, this is how we're doing it. Sinclair method, look it up." Mm-hmm. And to their credit, some of them, the next time I wrote the script, say, "Oh yeah, you're that doctor again writing that, so it's okay this time because I looked at it and it looks really interesting. How does it work? Are your patients getting better?" I said, "You know, I'm offering something that's helpful for people that have not had success."
Right.
See, that's the grassroots
part,
movement.
Mm-hmm. That's the part that's exciting. That's the part we're here to celebrate.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And
it's like the old shampoo commercial in the 70s. If you tell someone and so on. Was that a shampoo commercial? I'm looking at the youngster here.
Well, she does have nice hair.
Yeah. No, it's all about one person tells somebody. Luann, you have billions of fans. Right. If you talk about the Sinclair method even one time,
right,
you could save countless lives.
Well, absolutely. I mean, not enough people know about it, and that's you know, part of the problem, obviously. And if it could reach more people, it could help a lot more people. So,
and I think it's the naltrexone is reaching more people. Like, I do think there's more people that have heard of it, that understand that it's used for, you know, in alcohol or an opiate, you know, that it's used. But it's the targeted naltrexone use. It's the Sinclair method that I still feel like we have a ways to go and really spreading the word. And, you know, just my experiences, you know, purely sort of anecdotally and in my practice is there's a big difference between just taking naltrexone and the Sinclair method, the targeted naltrexone usage. Well, huge night and day difference.
Yeah, I say to people, if you take it in the morning as prescribed, this is what most doctors say, take it in the morning and don't drink. Take it in the morning, an hour later when it's at its peak plasma level, what is it blocking? You making love to your wife? You eating your breakfast? You having coffee? You playing with your children? You walking your dog?
Right.
What is it blocking? Mm-hmm. The camaraderie you have at work? There's endorphins that are created naturally? That's what you're blocking, really. Mm-hmm. And then by the time it wears off, the half-life is 10 to 12 hours. What if you burn through it in 6 to 8 hours?
Right.
By the time it burns off, it's cocktail hour.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yep. Does that make any sense at all?
None.
So you're blocking all the beauty of your day, the endorphins from... You want to target the behavior you want to decrease or stop.
Right. So, therefore, an hour before.
Yeah. Before the behavior you want to decrease or stop, which is, in this case, drinking.
Was it originally made for this... for people who drink, or was there another pharmacology to this medication? Do you guys know?
It was.
Does it help other?
I don't remember now, but I think originally it was for the treatment of alcohol.
Okay.
And then later on, it also got approved for opiate and heroin.
Okay. So we have naloxone.
I was just wondering the origins and how it came about.
Yeah, and
it
I don't remember all the details, but it's, you know, Claudia's point is well taken, is because of some strange paradigm where we're not going to offer a medication that is going to include drinking because that seems like we're encouraging drinking, even though the studies with rats that don't have this stigma, it was very successful in a rat study. Mm-hmm. And so somehow and I don't even know if that's the proper word, but it somehow changed the protocol in order to fit the dominant medical or societal paradigm, which is crazy. Mm-hmm. But and I think because of that, it was not successful as a treatment for alcohol because they took it in the morning and then they didn't drink until the medication had lost its effectiveness.
Right.
So there's one thing you remember, anybody listening, is if you do have the good fortune to have someone willing to prescribe this, take the pill, wait an hour, and then drink, and maybe discuss how it affected you when you did take that medication as prescribed by Dr. Sinclair.
Well, I took it according to the book that I read by Dr. Escapa based on Sinclair's work. And I just said, okay, it's an hour before. So I took it and I waited an hour, and that glass of red wine, which was my poison, just sat there. I had no interest in it. I was naive back then. I didn't know that you should eat prior to taking it. So I took 50 milligrams on an empty stomach and I felt a little dizzy. Mm-hmm. And then I had a few nights of sleeplessness and a little bad sleep, but that was about it. Those side effects dissipated within a week. Within 3 months, I realized that I had not thought about alcohol in 4 days or 5 days. And that was staggering to me because prior to that, if I was not drinking, all I was doing is thinking about the fact that I couldn't drink.
Right.
I would plan my days either around drinking or not drinking. It was my sobriety was not a happy sobriety prior to TSM. Mm. My sobriety was based on, okay, I can't go here, I can't do this, I can't be triggered by that, I can't go to the supermarket, this one, you know, memories and all this stuff.
Right.
So I realized then that I was looking, I say this in my TED talk, I saw a billboard that used to previously trigger me of a huge glass of red wine that had been there for ages. And I saw that billboard and it registered in my mind that it was a billboard with a glass of wine.
Right.
And that was it. And I literally pulled over
the sexiness
and wept.
Was gone.
I burst into tears because I realized my brain was normal again.
Mm-hmm.
I had no compulsive thoughts.
Right.
I had no compulsive actions. I was Claudia again. And that's what was really staggering
to me.
That's
amazing.
That I felt normal again.
Yeah.
And I was back to being a normal human being without a compulsive disorder of the brain. And that's exactly what it felt like. As if I was hijacked when I was engaged in the behavior of compulsive drinking.
Yeah. Oh, you couldn't get me a glass of wine quick enough at a restaurant. It's like, where is the wine?
Oh, and I never paid attention to the conversation.
Yeah.
You're looking at the bottle.
Right. You're thinking out. You're just wondering, you know, how you're going to get to that glass of.
We were talking yesterday. I was talking to some of the ladies here, and I said I was the girl that would look at someone who left a half a glass of wine at the table, and I would turn around when everyone turned around to leave the restaurant, and I would turn around and finish that glass.
Right.
I mean, that's not normal behavior.
Right. No.
This is not normal behavior.
No, when you start sneaking around.
So for me, it was a miracle.
Yeah.
It was a miracle. And I remained on it for 9 years. And then I just stopped drinking because it no longer served me. There's a huge correlation between hormones and women and drinking. And I think when you're perimenopausal or premenstrual or postnatal or all of these things that it affects you adversely.
Totally.
Alcohol is
my,
much
my father
worse.
Was an alcoholic, and he did not become an alcoholic until much later in his life, in his 50s. I believe it was a midlife crisis. He never really drank.
Could be a lack of testosterone. Who knows if it's a
hormonal
balance.
Who knows, but it's funny
men.
You should bring up hormones because I think it's important, you know.
Women really have to be aware of that. So many of my clients are, they say, oh, it's really weird. I binge right before my period. Well, hello.
Yeah, yeah. You're all over the place.
Hand in hand, or after birth, after giving birth.
Exactly.
I started drinking heavily after my second child. Well, let's take a look at that. There's There are very few studies on the relationship between hormones, women, and drinking.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
Makes sense.
I should point out, you're one of the outliers. If you're out there listening and say, okay, you're going to take this pill and not even want to drink your first drink, that's not the experience of most. You're probably 10%. And it's fortunate, but it doesn't mean it's not going to work for others. And so the idea is you take the pill, wait the requisite hour, and then drink. And when I describe this to people, my suggestion is they don't try to decrease the amount they drink, is to be very aware of whether or not they want the next one.
Mm-hmm.
And get out of that autonomic kind of like, oh, I got one and I'll pour the next one. Or if you're with friends and they're filling up your glass without you asking. So rather than just out of habit or compulsion, really be conscious about whether or not you want that drink. And over time, it may be weeks, it may be months, just like Pavlov's dog that stopped salivating when they no longer had the reward of food, so too that naltrexone will take away the reward, the dopamine hit that a person get gradually to the point where this is sacrilegious for a lot of people, is a person with alcohol use disorder can become a quote-unquote normie. And that's not, I'll let you comment on that from your line of work. That's that's like crazy. No one in the dominant paradigm in psychology or therapy would accept that position.
For sure. I mean, the idea of doing a harm reduction model with alcohol use disorder is, for some people, they think that is, right, truly, you know, blasphemy. And for almost 100 years now, the prevailing treatment for alcohol use disorder was the 12-step program and was an abstinence-based program. And, you know, the way I look at it is, thank God it came around when it did. People, a lot of people were dying from alcoholism. It was definitely treating, it was giving hope to people who were being criminalized and who were literally being kicked out on the street because they had severe alcoholism and nobody was helping them. But a lot's happened in 100 years, right? A lot's happened. And so we know that alcohol use disorder is a chronic disease. It's a chronic condition like diabetes that needs to be managed in multiple ways. There's no one piece, like, or one factor to it. It's looking at the whole person. It's looking at mental, emotional, physical, hormones, nutrition, all of it. And treating the person, you know, treating the whole person. And if we can do that and we can intervene early enough in it being a problem, I think that's also key, right? Then guess what? People can just change their relationship with alcohol, much like a diabetic needs to change their relationship with food. Mm-hmm. They can't, you know, go on insulin but still eat a bag of cookies, mm-hmm. right? They've got to change their relationship with sugar and food and take medication, and then they can have a piece of birthday cake, you know, to celebrate.
I heard an analogy once, which is like, it's like forming new, you have to like dig new roots for the water to flow.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? You keep on letting the water flow down this one, you know, river. You have to dig yes. new pathways, and your brain has to, you know, learn new pathways. That yeah. takes time. And but once you set that pathway, it's, you know, you change a muscle, change your mind, right?
And that's why I'm such a big advocate of everything, you know, Claudia's doing and Dr. Nelson and myself, because I think, again, if people have heard about the Sinclair method, they think it's a magic pill. And I just take this right. magic
yeah,
pill.
No. Right. And say that again.
Yes,
no, I think. I want to clarify that, too. This is, when you hear my
too
story,
good to be true, right?
understand that, that this is not the norm, and that I went through for 9 years on TSM. I went through major ups and downs. So this is not a magic pill. You have to treat it holistically, and this is why we've created so many resources at C3 Foundation. Drink logs help enormously. The apps that we created for phones, we found through data that people who keep track of their drinks actually do better. They just do better. They're accountable. They have mindfulness. They ask themselves, like Dr. Nelson says, do I really want or need the second drink, and why? Mm. And if you just take that one little moment, it makes a major difference in, once again, as you're saying, of rewiring your brain to be mindful and right. not be automatic.
Right.
So those resources, plus the online meetings that we have and the peer support.
I want to interrupt just for a second because to that point. As a physician, I'll tell people, one of the most important things you can do is take this drink log and complete it.
Mm-hmm.
Guess how many of my patients complete it when they have their return visit?
How many?
A percentage.
100%?
No.
10%.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
You know, this is, you got to understand, we've found that people do so much better that keep a drink log. In fact, they keep it for 2 years.
I'm with you.
Those are the patients right. that have a 95 or 100% success
rate. Well, because
rate.
They're putting the time in, you know, you have
It's accountability. Yeah, it's reminding you that, so you don't get sloppy. Right. That when people get sloppy and they say they don't have their medication, oh, I forgot it when I went to Mexico.
Right.
And I drank without it. And guess what? You relearn the behavior either overnight or in a couple of days, and then you drink more than ever because you've been... You haven't been drinking. So it can, you know, people can have spectacular relapses on this. Yeah. So it's not just keeping the medication with you at all times and keeping a drink log, but it's also having community. Now, there wasn't community when I started TSM, but there is now.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So there's no excuse to not join a couple of the meetings or the peer support online.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So there's lots of resources.
I had just recently, actually, one of my client's objections to the log, I was glad she finally shared it with me, because then we could work around the objection, was she didn't want anybody to find it. And she was scared that even though it was in her phone or in her laptop, that somebody in her office, somebody would be able to see it. Mm-hmm. I said, fantastic, great. We can work with that. Create a log and just use the numbers. Name it whatever you want to name it. Just
calories,
how many
whatever.
Units. Just put units. How many units No one has
keep
to know
journal,
what it
handwritten
is.
Handwritten journal.
Yes.
Right.
So that's a good.
That was our workaround.
That's the first good explanation as to why someone wouldn't do it.
Privacy.
And, yes, I think privacy is part of it.
Super important.
I think also people have had so much shame ingrained in them that they have alcohol use disorder. And again, I always reference the diabetes because I think there's so many parallels, mm-hmm. just like we shame people who are overweight, right? Yeah. There's so much shame that I have this problem with alcohol because we've told people for 100 years it's a character issue, right. it's moral a willpower thought. Issue, right. or it's a moral failure. Mm-hmm. This is could not be further from the truth, right? So then when people write it down, they have so much guilt and shame, which again, you know, is why I'm just so excited about Deerhaven to bring in the clinical services mm-hmm. to help people with that too, is, hey, we're unwiring all this shame, all this kind of negativity, this concept you've had of yourself into, oh, I've had a medical disorder and right. I was not diagnosed properly or given the proper treatment.
Right.
Right? That can really change things.
I almost wish we can rename it because like alcoholic, there's like a stigma already attached to it. If you say diabetes
yes.
or heart disease, it doesn't have the same effect as alcoholic.
Yeah. There's a charge on that.
I don't use that word. I don't use
right?
sober.
Just,
I don't use any
so
of those words because
already,
they do.
You know?
It also to be forced to, and I'm not dissing 12-step programs for whomever they work, that's terrific, but to be forced to label yourself as an alcoholic, mm-hmm. even when you have 10 years of sobriety,
right.
to me seems like, and then the punitive action of, let's say you have one beer after 20 years of sobriety
yeah.
and you are exiled.
Right.
You have to start over again. Start over. Your chips are taken
that.
Away.
I had the same thought
yeah,
as you.
Yeah, I know. It's like
really? You have to go all the way back after 20 years because you had a beer?
Yeah.
I mean, come on.
All the way back. And,
so that's the
and
only thing,
it's,
yeah.
It's quite punitive and it's interesting. And funny thing you said about the drink log is mm-hmm. I think a lot of people don't understand how much they're drinking. And
agreed.
So when they mm-hmm. learn how to track units,
mm-hmm.
some of them are floored saying,
yes.
I drank 86
yes.
units.
A lot of shame
yes. and that provokes.
Or their
yes.
shot, instead of this, their shot is like that.
Well, that's why yes. I tell people, get a shot measurement and learn what a restaurant wine pour is, because most people I talk to say, oh, I just fill up my burgundy glass. I'm
right.
like, that's...
that's half a bottle.
That's a half a bottle. Yeah, exactly.
Right there.
I think
yeah.
all of us know
a
when
good
we're
burgundy
talking...
glass, that's half a bottle.
Yeah, yeah, talking to somebody in the very beginning who's, you know, interested in getting help, and so you kind of ask them to, you know, give you their averages, you know, quantity and frequency, just plan on doubling it, or at
yeah.
least you just know that's not right.
Yeah, and you know
yeah.
one of the things that I find is someone will come back after 30 days and I'll say, okay, here's how you do it. You take the pill, wait an hour, then you drink as the way we described, with conscious thought of, do I really want that drink? Allowing the medication to effectively do what it needs to do, and that's interrupt the reward over time, extinguishing their desire to drink. And yet, when they come back, I'll say, how'd it go? I don't know. Well, let's look at the drink log.
Yeah.
Well, I think I was better. And that's why I said it's so mm-hmm. difficult to
yeah.
figure out whether or not
yeah,
it's really working
yeah.
without the number.
The black and white. And
yeah.
when you look at it, some people will say, well, I only decreased by 25%. I'm thinking, well, it's been 3 weeks.
Right.
Yeah.
You decreased by a quarter.
25% yeah. is good. Yeah.
That's
yeah.
huge. People don't give themselves the credit of
right.
when they say, oh, wow, I reduced by 10 units or whatever. That's huge. Think of all the time that you were drinking that much.
Right.
And by taking one, I always forget, one little pill, one small pill.
One little pill.
I got to work on my brain. One little pill. So a great documentary. And I would suggest anybody, if you're just learning about this, those people that are on your side, your loved ones, your spouse, your friends, they need to be educated. Because mm-hmm. if you're telling someone, I'm working on my problem, I have a problem with alcohol, and they're like, what do you mean? I just saw you drinking. Mm-hmm. Well, I had this one little pill.
So that's why I made the documentary.
Yeah, and yeah, you sit with your spouse. Sit mm-hmm. with your spouse. It's wonderfully done. Explains it.
Mm-hmm.
It gives it a human side. And so now you're working as a team instead of looking at, mm-hmm. I thought you said you're working on. So that's super important.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask about the online meetings. I mean, is it like AA where you have online Zoom meetings? You have mm-hmm. the same for...
There's a meeting every week in different time zones. They're called TSM meetups. And
TSM
meetups, and they're run by various people who've been on TSM, and they're sort of the moderators. But it's just a, it's, there's
a network of TSMers.
Yeah. Is that on your website, or is it the C3?
All of the, in C3 Foundation website, there's a tab called Resources, okay. And there you can find your drink log app, all of the Facebook pages, all of the link to the forum and these meetings, which are called TSM meetups. There's links to every single free resource, and then there's paid resources, which are, we have a coaching page where we have coaches that will help you if you're on TSM.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, and there's
so
links
there's
to everything
place to
there.
Go.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's like one-stop shopping mm-hmm. for the people who want to find out or show their loved ones. There's also a medical page for medical providers, which mm-hmm. is c3foundation.net. So c3foundation.org is for the layperson.
Yeah.
.net is for a doctor to learn about and to see all the clinical trials and everything.
Okay, great. I think it's important information people know.
There's
where
to so go. Much resource, and it's. I think the challenge as a doctor, when we first look at that, they're like, "Well, if it works so well, and is so successful, why haven't I heard of it?" Right. And my answer to that is, if the dominant medical paradigm and treatment is 12-step in abstinence, and if we look at statistics, out of all the people that could benefit from a treatment of alcohol, let's say conservatively 10%. The people pursue treatment, and what that normally is 12-step in abstinence, and then supported maybe with counseling. And then if those people have a 10% long-term sobriety, mm-hmm. that's probably even optimistic. Mm-hmm. So out of the people that could benefit from a disease that's, you know, devastates our healthcare system, mm-hmm. our families, the financial wherewithal of the people involved, and breaks down family, and all the problems associated, drunk driving, you know, we could go into it more and more, that if the overall success rate is 1%, why are we still talking about that as the only mm-hmm. way to treat? And if you're not doing that, you're not serious about your recovery.
I say this about rehabs. I said, you know, people make, it's like the fodder for late night comedians. Oh, Ben Affleck's going to rehab again.
Yeah.
Would that be funny if he was going for heart treatment again? And,
right.
and eight times it didn't work? Wouldn't you say, what's going on with these heart specialists? Yeah, why aren't right. they treating his condition?
Absolutely, because it's not looked at as a disease. Then that's
yeah,
the real
but
issue.
I mean, someone going to rehab eight
yeah,
times,
right.
that means the treatment is ineffective.
Right.
I'm
yeah.
sorry.
Yeah,
it's
well,
ineffective
the national
treatment.
Average is five. So the national average is five inpatient residential treatment attempts.
Well, the point, the basic point
yeah.
is when you can double
yeah.
your chances,
so you know,
why not double your chances?
Money that is?
Mm-hmm. You know?
That's why. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's a revolving door policy. And as we were talking about earlier, you've got people mortgaging their houses because
yeah.
they're so
mm-hmm.
desperate to save their child,
right.
sending them to these expensive rehab
yeah.
facilities, and the kid gets out and mm-hmm. relapses within a month.
Right. Yeah. Right.
And so, you know, we can, mm-hmm. you probably are better at talking about statistics because it's not, you know, a small percentage, it's some significant success rates with the.
With the Sinclair method?
Yes.
Why,
yeah,
not,
I mean,
why not double your chances?
No, this isn't nearly,
why?
It's more
why
than
not?
That. It's more than that. It's even if, for the people who just
or triple
did,
your chances.
Who just yeah. popped the pill right. and were religious about medication adherence, they have nearly 80% success rate.
Mm.
But if you add in things like support, drink log,
right.
Therapy,
right.
coaching, all that stuff, mm-hmm. you have an even higher rate of success.
Sure.
There are people who don't comply. There are people who fudge a bit. You know,
right.
they'll start drinking before the hour is up. You can't do that.
Mm-hmm.
If you do it fastidiously, and then there's a very small percentage of the population who don't genetically respond to it, but that's tiny.
It's right. small.
I mean, I think that in the 13 years I've been doing that, I've probably met two people who seriously tried TSM so
right.
bad, so much, and
right.
it just didn't work for
right.
them.
Yeah, I think it's probably in the 5%, maybe,
yeah.
of the people I see.
And noncompliance is the biggest issue.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's why all of the additional wraparound support is so
well
necessary.
It's so necessary.
Because, you know, individuals are going to get to some point where they're going to have a desire to be noncompliant. And that's because they have a severe trigger around something. And so they want to drink and experience the effects.
Mm.
So they
numb
don't.
Themselves.
Yeah. They want to numb or escape. That is one I've seen, of course, failing to plan, right? So being in the moment, you haven't planned, you didn't take your naltrexone,
mm-hmm.
and you're kind of overcome with cravings because you're in the moment where other people
right.
are drinking, mm-hmm. right? So there's going to be these situations, and having that additional support is the key to people being successful and compliant long term. Yep. Because what I've seen happen is once that there's an episode of drinking without naltrexone, it starts to snowball. Right, it starts to snowball very quickly, and the brain's like,
yeah,
right,
because you woke up the dragon.
Yes, and so you know, it's not just that one episode. It can turn into weeks or days, if not weeks, and then people are discouraged, which is understandable.
Sure,
but with the right support and the right tools, people can get right back in it and take that as a learning, experience.
Okay, not a failure.
Exactly. Right. It's not a failure. It's a learning experience. Okay, I didn't plan that so great, or I was really triggered. Well, guess what? Naltrexone is not going to take away triggers, right? That's not what it's meant to do. And so then I need other tools, So then I've got the tools with my coach, with my therapist, hearing from other people. Mm-hmm. And then that's how people get 100% success rate with TSM.
But that's the hard part.
Yeah.
That's the hard part. Is for some, just to take the pill and then to drink as prescribed, that's even difficult. But if you're asking people to really go in and get to work about the stuff that's driving their behavior, who wants to get into that?
Ask them, would they rather go to a meeting every day of their life?
Yeah.
I mean, you've got a choice here. But any recovery route you take, any option you choose, you have to commit to it.
It
requires effort. Yeah. I mean, we all know that. Yeah. You can't just, it's the same as a diet.
Right.
You can't pop a diet pill. People try it and then they gain back the weight even more.
Yeah, exactly.
If you don't change your life, you change your...
Well, like a diabetic would change the way he eats because...
Exactly. Right? Yeah. Exactly.
The people ask me, Doc, what are the side effects? There's got to be some side effects.
Yeah, I was going to ask that.
And if you have a list of the laundry list of all the potential side effects, the only one I ever see with any level of consistency is nausea.
Nausea. Mm-hmm. And if you just have a bottle of Pepto-Bismol on hand or something that is an over-the-counter anti-nausea medication, you can alleviate that instantaneously. Mm-hmm.
Well, and the other ones that they talk about, it leads us back to that other premise is that it's a biological treatment. It's not a psychological treatment. Mm-hmm. And so somebody, they're so excited in the honeymoon period. Oh, man, I'm cutting my drinks back. I'm doing really well. Mm-hmm. Suddenly, they've lost that alcohol that they were self-medicating. Mm-hmm. And so now they're like, that naltrexone makes me nervous.
Yes.
I'm angry.
Yes.
I'm depressed. Yes. I'm like, well... Could it possibly be that now you're feeling those feelings because you're not covering up with alcohol?
Yeah. Right.
No.
Right.
So, but I think that is
massive. I see this
massive,
all the time online. Mm-hmm. People talking about nalovers and all this. Yes. There was no such thing as a nalover until Facebook, started getting a hold of it. And
that's one of the biggest things is you start to feel emotions. And, I always treat it like a wave, let it come. And let it go, just sit in it, you know?
And also, I think that's a reason for someone to say, it didn't work. Because it's like, I'm feeling this and that. It's a side effect, so it didn't work. Once again, I've confirmed my belief that I'm beyond help. I'm never going to get well. Mm-hmm. Instead of saying, okay, that's what you're experiencing now. Now it's time to get to work and, reach out for some good resources.
The
group or working with Gabrielle.
And I'll tell you something.
It's about taking that pause.
Taking the pause and sitting.
Taking the pause.
And also determining if that's a trigger or a memory or an actual craving or an emotion. Mm-hmm. And then if it is an emotion, let yourself feel it. I'll tell you, just going through major things like loss or deaths when you don't have the numbing effect of alcohol is... I don't want to call it easier because that makes that sort of denigrates the pain of losing someone you love. But it allows the process of grieving to happen. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you're pushing it down and you're pushing these emotions down, you're not processing grief. You're not processing mourning. Mm-hmm. You're not processing your divorce or your loss, whatever it is that you're experiencing in life. And that's when it sticks in you.
Right.
And people who are shoving it down with substances will have these traumatic incidents in their body for so much longer than people who simply feel.
Yeah, of course. It lives on a cellular level.
Yes.
There's nothing that a drink won't make worse. That's how I...
There you go. It.
Carol Truman wrote this book like 25 years ago. It's an oldie but a goodie. And the title says it all. Feelings Buried Alive Never Die.
That's
true.
Yeah. We loved in this culture to think if the event is over and I didn't process it, and I just sort of tucked it away that, like, I'm good to go, and I never have to deal with it. And that's my whole world, right, is helping people with that's actually not how the emotional brain works at all. And if it's been buried, it's going to recycle and come up at a time that will be inopportune. Is to say it, politely. It'll be inopportune.
But part of the disease. You
know, No, it's also, I mean, people manifest cancers and all sorts of and stomach issues and so forth because they're just holding in all this.
Yes.
Not allowing themselves
psychosomatic,
to feel.
That's real.
But one of the things really
psychosomatic illnesses. I mean, I've known women. I know a woman in Switzerland that was paralyzed herself
because she was. It was all
depression, and it was all stress.
But we're a society that doesn't allow for these feelings. You're supposed to man up or chin up or do whatever, and you're supposed to push everything down and just carry through.
Even more so in Europe. I'm talking about in Europe.
Oh my God, the Brits. It's like carry on.
Oh, carry on.
You just lost your leg. Carry on.
That's right.
Your dad just died. Carry on. Yeah. You know, chin up, man up, all that stuff, and it's really unhealthy. And it manifests later on in life with ill health and a myriad of other issues.
So I have as one of my intake questions on my questionnaire, I ask, so who taught you how to manage your emotions in a healthy way? Did you learn that in grade school? Did you learn that? And nobody answers that with anything. They're like, I didn't learn it. Nowhere. Okay, great. All right, so now we're on the same page, right? Because all of us did not really, most of us, I should say, did not kind of get to adulthood fully equipped with all the tools for how to manage the emotional brain, which is nine times the size of the logical brain, right? So we're really all at a deficit if we don't have those. But that's what I love about the Sinclair, because the way I do it with folks is, you know, I set up the expectation from the beginning that I hope they have the experience you have, but I set them up for the expectation that that extinction period could be 9 months, it could be a year.
9 to 12 months is average.
Average. So I set them up with that, and I say, you may not really notice anything significant. I use that word carefully, like there's changes, but they may not notice it's a significant change. Hey, that could be month three, that could be month four. But here's what you and I are going to do in those 2 to 3 months, is we are going to build your toolbox. We are going to get you rock solid on your skills. So when you start reducing your drinking, when the medication is really at its full effect and you feel like, hey, I don't need that last drink, and you start to feel things, you're equipped and you've got some tools and skills. And it's one of the most challenging things I think about traditional treatment. I worked in it for years. People are drinking, numbing, escaping, and not dealing with anything. And the next day, they're feeling at a level, you know, 20 out of 10. And they have no tools, right? And they're just sitting in that intense, flooded emotional place.
Anxiety.
Oh, you name it. Grief, anxiety, shame, anger. I mean, all of it. It's a rough way to go. It's a rough, rough way to go. So,
I just saw Mel Brooks singing High Anxiety right when you said that. High Anxiety. It's not funny for those people going through it.
Because
then what do you
not
do?
Not a good
when,
feeling.
When you have that feeling, what do most people do? They go for another drink in order
to quell the anxiety.
And it's a vicious circle. Once the alcohol wears off and the sugar kicks in and the cortisol levels go up.
Then you wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning.
3 o'clock in the morning and then you go get a beer downstairs. And now you're... drinking 24/7.
Right.
Yeah. You know.
So we have some other guests.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So I think I'm going to excuse myself and invite somebody else in.
Okay.
If that's...
And I'm going to do the same because I actually need to head to the airport.
Okay.
But how does that sound?
You and me, we could talk all day about this.
So you got some rain here in North Carolina. You got back to some sun in San Diego.
Yes.
Thanks. It
was great talking with both of you. You too.
Should we take a break?
Do you just want to do a quick closer? Thank you so much.
Yeah, I think so, right?
Sure thing.
Okay.
Thank you, Dr. Nelson, for hosting
this. Thank you for hosting, perfect.
I'd like to thank everybody for joining us, Luann, Claudia, and Gabrielle. And thanks for our listeners. We hope that you walk away from this knowing there is a treatment that has high-level success that you probably haven't heard of. And pursue a doctor that would be willing to prescribe this. And I suggest you get to the C3 organization.
C3foundation.org.
C3foundation.org. So thanks again, and
Thank you, Dr. Nelson.
We hope you enjoyed it and hope you learned something.
And thank you to Deer Haven Gardens for allowing us to do this podcast from here. Mm-hmm.
Thanks for listening to Your Road to Personal Addiction Recovery with Dr. William Nelson. Listen live each week at this time or anytime 24/7 on demand at starworldwidenetworks.com.